It's Thursday, May 25th. It could have been worse. One of Elon Musk's rockets could have exploded during the announcement. We start here. After a glitchy entrance, Governor Ron DeSantis dives into the campaign space.
We will never surrender to the woke mob.
But he's got more to worry about than tech issues, where the former co-front runner goes from here. It's time to start planning for America to default on its debts, but does the White House have a plan?
For the first time ever, it might need to decide who gets paid and who doesn't.
What actually happens once we hit the deadline? And a multi-state battle is now water under the bridge.
These states were not going to be able to continue business as usual.
Why Western states just gave up some of their rights to their most valuable resource. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. If you had to pick a standard way to start a presidential campaign, it would be simple. Release a YouTube video, then give a speech to your biggest fans, tried and true. Yesterday afternoon, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis did put out a video revealing what many have known for months. He's running for president.
Our border is a disaster. Crime infests our cities.
But then, instead of giving a speech to a crowd, he tried something different. He decided to give his first live address via streaming audio on Twitter.
All right. Good afternoon, good evening, or good morning, everyone, depending on wherever in the world you're joining us from.
This was Twitter Spaces, where DeSantis was joined by one of his most prominent supporters, the tech entrepreneur David Sacks, along with the owner of Twitter himself, Elon Musk.
Tonight, I'm pleased to introduce two individuals who've done more to loosen the grip.
But for several uncomfortable minutes, nothing seemed to work.
Let's see. So, here we go. Yeah, I think so.
Just to simplify this.
Musk and DeSantis spun this as a victory in and of itself. This event was being watched so widely by more than 500,000 people that it was breaking the site.
Yeah, I think we've got just a massive number of people online, so it's servers are straining somewhat.
Eventually, they fired up a new stream, and DeSantis gave his speech.
Well, I am running for president of the United States to lead our great American comeback.
First impressions do make a difference, but not always for the reasons you think. The descent down a golden escalator was bizarre until it wasn't.
Biden's allowed woke ideology to drive his agenda. We will never surrender to the woke mob, and we will leave woke ideology in the dustbin of history.
So what happens now that Donald Trump's main rival, Ron DeSantis, is officially running against him? Let's start the day with Galen Druk from our partners at 538, where he hosts the 538 Politics podcast. Galen, a few months ago, Ron DeSantis was polling pretty well head-to-head in matchups against Trump. Where does he stand at this moment?
As we talk today, Donald Trump is polling at around 53% in our polling averages of the Republican primary, and DeSantis is polling at around 20%. If you go back just a few months, the gap between Trump and DeSantis was only 15 points. Now, of course, it's more than 30. And if you go even further back, you see that in head-to-head polling, at one point, DeSantis was actually besting Trump. That was right after the 2022 midterms, where Ron DeSantis performed really well in the governor's race in Florida, winning by almost 20 points.
Florida held the line.
Florida is a purple battleground state where we generally think of things as being really competitive. Now, what's happened since then? Some of the glow has faded.
Oh, I think DeSantis can do okay with farmers. I don't think so. Based on polls, he's not doing okay with anything.
If you listen to the way that Trump tells the story, is that as, for example, Democrats or Alvin Bragg, for example, the district attorney in Manhattan, has charged Trump, it's rallied Republicans around him.
I was going to say, Galen, like the thing that's changed that I can count is an indictment and also a jury who sided with a woman who accused Trump of sexual abuse. Like those are the major plot points in the last couple months.
Yeah. So, of course, part of Trump's pitch has always been they're going to come after me, but I'm a fighter and you need to rally around me so that I can fight them. And that's perhaps part of what's going on. But of course, in this dynamic, you have to look at both Trump and DeSantis. And DeSantis' story has changed a little bit as well over the past few months. And I would call this aspect of, you know, DeSantis' story perhaps the Ted Cruzification of Ron DeSantis, which is that Ron DeSantis was popular in Florida during COVID and in the year or so after many of the restrictions faded away.
Florida was a refuge of sanity when the world went mad. We stood as a citadel of freedom for people across this country and indeed across the world.
And he was clearly winning independent voters if he was getting, you know, a 20-point win in Florida. The issues that made him so popular were bucking the restrictions of sort of Democratic states and cities, the toughest COVID restrictions, and also this general anti-woke position that he took.
We must fight the woke in our schools. We must fight the woke in our businesses.
Those are positions that are on the side generally of public opinion, majority public opinion in America. However, DeSantis has gone beyond those things that sort of cut across the electorate to talk more about things like abortion and the LGBT community.
Some of the people in Washington, like, can we actually agree that women get pregnant and not men? Because they don't seem to say that.
And things that we think of as being like the old school Republican culture wars that they don't actually perform quite as well on. You can go too far. And ultimately, that's kind of the way that Ted Cruz was viewed in the 2016 primary. Yes, he was very conservative, and this is a Republican primary, but voters picked the candidate that they viewed as more moderate, which in this case was Donald Trump, the person who wasn't talking about gay people or abortion quite as much, and the person who said that he didn't want to cut Social Security or Medicare spending.
Well, at this point, I mean, Trump does talk about these social issues. The entire GOP talks about these social issues. And recently, we've seen conservatives echo this language against diversity and inclusion. We've seen beer companies get boycotted because they had the temerity to work with trans folks. Just this week, Target, the store chain, was convinced to shelve some of its items that it was going to sell during Pride Month because its employees have been physically threatened, they said. So, I mean, is this two different candidates or is this a changing GOP? And how does that affect this race we're about to see?
Yeah, it's a good question. When it comes to the culture wars, there are some areas where Democrats are more on the side of majority opinion, and there are some issues where Republicans are more on the side of majority opinion. Now, questions about trans identity are relatively new for Americans, and so opinions are still forming, but we generally see that Americans believe that gender is assigned at birth. They are sort of skeptical of the use of, for example, hormone therapies for minors, things like that. But we also see repeatedly in the polling that Americans are against discrimination of LGBTQ people. And so there's a fine line in these sort of cultural issues that you have to walk if you want to stay on the right side of public opinion, which is, you know, express concern about the issues that Americans are concerned about, but also not seem like a total jerk, because then Americans won't like you and won't want to vote for you or think that you sort of have general goodwill towards the people that you want to represent.
So if you're DeSantis, what do you do? Like, how do you narrow the gap over these next several months?
Yeah, it's going to be tricky for any Republican entering this primary race, because if you don't attack Trump, you might as well not have a primary. You know, he's already above 50% in the polls. So in order for someone else to win, he has to decline in the polls. Just numerically, that's how it's going to have to work. At the same time, he has a lot of goodwill amongst Republican voters. They generally have a favorable opinion of him. And so I think DeSantis sees that, and his strategy first and foremost is going to be an electability argument, basically saying, look, Trump lost in 2020. I don't know if he'll say that in quite those exact words, but you may like all the things that Trump says, but it doesn't matter if he can't win an election and actually enact the policies.
We chose freedom over Fauciism, just like Iowa, and we were right and they were wrong.
One strategy in primaries like this is you build on your successes. So you try really hard to perform well in Iowa. Iowa is a particularly, you know, religious, conservative state, particularly amongst the Republican caucus voters there. And so we've seen DeSantis run to the right of Trump on the issue of abortion, which is something that evangelical Christians care deeply about. And so that's probably a play at Iowa, for example. You know, if you win in Iowa, you can sometimes build on that success, try to do well in New Hampshire. I mean, his pitch in New Hampshire is going to be a little bit different. It's more for the college-educated voter, the moderate voter, which he was doing well with. But it'll be a question of whether he can sort of run far to the right and still be favored amongst a more moderate or college-educated crowd.
All right. Galen Druk from 538. Really interesting. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Next up on Start Here, what's the plan for the debt ceiling? Well, the Treasury Secretary says she doesn't have to plan for it. Feel better? We're back after the break. With daylight saving time upon us, we're looking forward to more daylight and longer days from March through November. And while setting our clocks forward gives us the illusion of more time, it doesn't necessarily help businesses find qualified candidates any sooner. Fear not, there is a solution. ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter is your 24/7 hiring partner working tirelessly to connect you with the right candidate. Once you post your job on ZipRecruiter, it gets distributed to over 100 job sites, ensuring you reach a diverse pool of qualified individuals. Their smart technology scans thousands of resumes, matching you with people whose skills perfectly align with your job requirements. Spring forward with a new hiring partner, ZipRecruiter, and find top talent sooner. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address to try ZipRecruiter for free, ZipRecruiter.com/start here. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/start here. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
The drama over the debt ceiling can look kind of the same every day. Like, people go into meetings, they come out, no deal yet. That was the same case yesterday. But two things did stick out to me that had nothing to do with politicians. One was stock prices continuing to go down faster. You can almost see traders getting a bit more nervous as we get closer to June 1st. Remember, that's the day we've been told the U.S. could default on the debts we promised to pay. The government's already promised to send out money for stuff like Social Security, but if we don't raise the debt ceiling, we can't cut those checks. The other thing I found interesting came from the person who first named June 1st as our national deadline.
I'm not going to speculate on precisely what will happen if that doesn't occur.
Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen was asked yesterday what would actually happen if the U.S. defaulted. She didn't have a lot of specifics, leading to the question, did she not want to say because that makes people panic, or do we really not know? ABC's Elizabeth Schulze covers economics and policy. Elizabeth, there was this moment when someone asked, like, say you have no money to pay out because you haven't raised the debt limit, whose money would dry up first? She couldn't answer, and it made me wonder for the first time, how do we know when the money's gone, Elizabeth? Like, what would a default actually look like?
Look, the unsatisfying answer here, Brad, is that we do not know. And the reason we don't know is because the U.S. has never defaulted on its debt. In its entire history of this country, this has never happened before. And it's something that the Treasury Secretary says often. It's something that traders who I talk to on Wall Street say often. No one exactly knows how this is going to play out. But what was really unsatisfying from this answer yesterday from Treasury Secretary Yellen is that she said we're not involved in planning if there's a default.
We are committed to not having missed payments and raising the debt ceiling, so that's not a situation we face.
Basically saying we're not even sure what's going to happen if we get to this point. And she said it's just not an acceptable state of affairs. Now, how much of that is a negotiating tactic to say we simply do not want to get to that point and we don't even want to open up the door to let people know what we're thinking if we get there? TBD. But the fact is that the government is in this position where for the first time ever, it might need to decide who gets paid and who doesn't. And that would have massive consequences on the U.S. and the global economy, Brad.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because if we're talking about June 1st as the date when, like, America essentially runs out of money to give, well, what happens if, like, the bill comes due for veterans benefits on the first of the month, and then Social Security comes due on the second of the month? Like, do we just pay the veterans first and then just wait to run out of money? Or do we try to spread it out so every American gets something? Like, what happens if we just don't have any money left on the horizon?
I mean, what the Treasury Secretary said is this is an impossible choice to have to make here. You're looking at the calendar of payments due. $47 billion is supposed to go out for Medicare on June 1st, $24 billion for veterans benefits and military right. and civil retirement that same day. The next day, it's $25 billion for Social Security. So how do you decide who is more deserving of those benefits than others? That is not a position that the government ever wanted to be in. And by the way, it's not a position that the government knows it can be in legally.
Prioritization is not really something that's operationally feasible. So there will be some difficult choices to make.
In the past, the Treasury Department has said it thinks it has the legal authority to prioritize which payments go out. But ultimately, if it was in a position where it was choosing one over another, Brad, that would almost certainly face legal challenges. Beyond just those federal payments for programs that millions of Americans rely on, Brad, the government also has to make payments out to people who own government debt. So that's bondholders. A lot of pension funds hold U.S. bonds. A lot of investors have U.S. bonds. Foreign countries hold on to U.S. bonds. Wall Street would be freaked out if all of a sudden the U.S. cannot pay interest that it owes on those bonds. That would be what's called a technical default. And a lot of investors are banking on this idea that ultimately the Treasury Department would choose to make those interest payments, pay out its creditors before possibly making out those payments to Americans for Medicare, Social Security, VA benefits.
Wait. The people, when little Johnny gets a little U.S. government bond on his graduation day or something, and that carries whatever interest that pays out in June of 2023, you're saying that person might get their money before the Social Security person would?
Exactly. One financial advisor I talked to today said that if you have a bill that is maturing on June 1st, you're going to get your money back. But that is not the case that you can for sure say that if you are a Medicare recipient on June 1st expecting a payment, you're going to get your money. And you can only imagine the political backlash that would ensue if that was the kind of decision that the Treasury Department found itself having to make. And it's why the Treasury Secretary said it is an impossibly hard choice.
And why you'd really want the Treasury Department to have a plan. And yet here they are essentially saying, we're not in charge of planning if this happens. It's all on you guys. All right. Elizabeth Schulze, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Brad.
Over the last several months, we've seen several states take direct aim at each other over things like abortion rights, migrant busing. But one of the most divisive conversations, especially in the western part of the U.S., is about something even more basic. States have been in a grudge match over water.
This is ground zero for climate change impacts on water in the United States, right here in the Colorado River Basin.
The mighty Colorado River is an important source of water, not just in Colorado, but in Arizona, Nevada, California. It slices through agricultural fields. It swells in dams. It powers homes and businesses as far away as Mexico. And yet states don't get to use all the water they want. There are limits. You gotta help the people downstream. And in a warming climate with growing demand, any decision had the power to impact millions. Well, this week, an agreement in that grudge match was reached. ABC Stephanie Ebbs covers climate issues. And Stephanie, we had heard it described as America's first great water war. Where did we land?
Yeah, so the war is far from over, but they got to a much more favorable outcome than one that a lot of people were dreading. You know, this week, the Interior Department announced that they had helped broker a deal between California, Arizona, and Nevada. They're called the Lower Basin States. They take water from the lower half of the Colorado River. And they basically agreed to collectively give up 3 million acre feet of water over the next 3 years. And the background to how we got to this point is, you know, as a lot of people have seen, the Colorado River has been under tremendous stress. It's essentially a mega drought, more than 20 years of intense drought conditions. So there's been an incredible amount of concern that if water levels continue to decline and decline and decline, that would threaten some very fundamental services and critical sources of water in the region.
These two fields on this farm will probably not get irrigated next year. So I'm going to lose.
You'll have nothing growing here next year?
Most likely.
And so earlier this year, the Interior Department basically came to all the states that take water from the Colorado River and said, you guys have to come to some kind of an agreement to decrease water use, or we're going to get involved.
Oh, yeah, and looking at like the back of the envelope, Matthew did Stephanie. This is like 30, that's like an eighth of their water allotment that they're giving up here. If you're one of these states, why would you make these concessions? Like if you're looking over at California, being like, wow, you guys are using a lot of water, you're using more and more. Why would you end up deciding, yeah, we'll give up some of ours?
You know, I think there's a lot of politics. There's a lot of things that go into this.
Right.
Water in the West is, you know, it can become an incredibly controversial topic. The thing that we know right now is that these states were not going to be able to continue business as usual.
The robust actions we have taken to date are not enough. Arizona, Nevada, and California have been meeting and are looking to do more.
The current situation of drought on the river means that they were all going to be faced with very difficult decisions and likely cuts. They have already faced cuts and had to agree to cuts of their water use up to this point. So it kind of came down to you can choose to offer those cuts yourselves, negotiate it, and actually get compensated for it. So these states are getting about $1.2 billion from the Inflation Reduction Act in exchange for making these decisions. So that's a big push.
Like or the federal government can just come in and do it and you don't get anything.
Right, exactly. And no state wants to have the federal government come in and mandate things that they don't have an agreement to. It was going to cause potentially years of protracted legal battles. And I think everyone, including the Biden administration, was really trying to make the case that it will be best for everyone involved to come to an agreement rather than force us to come in and like put the hammer down.
Because that's my other question is, so fine, you get extra money from the federal government in exchange, essentially, for some of these water rights you were hoping to get. But does that make that doesn't make water any less scarce, right? We're talking about drought conditions. What are the next several years going to look like in these places?
Right. And so one thing that we know happened this year is there was an incredible amount of rain, which didn't eliminate the drought conditions all along the Colorado River. But even some of the officials from states like Arizona have said having that cushion of extra water that came in this year did help kind of ease the negotiations into a deal like this because there's more water to go around right now. Going forward, they're still going to need to come up with plans. At any point during this deal, for example, in the next 3 years, if we have an intense drought year and the water levels in the reservoirs start to dip again, they're going to have to come back to the negotiating table.
We have a 23-year drought in this country. That is not going to be fixed by a deluge of rain every now and then. We have to reorganize ourselves. We have to come up with new and innovative ways to deal with that.
And they're going to continue to be at the negotiating table to figure out what happens after 2026. What we've seen with the way that climate change is impacting this river and impacting water in the West is that, you know, we're certainly not getting more of it on a consistent basis. So the general feeling is something's going to have to change. It's just a question of how drastic that is and how it's kind of worked out legally to make sure everyone's getting at least something that they want.
Yeah, we always talk about how individual events, yeah, that's weather. And we had some wet weather this winter. Climate is when you start adding up all these trends. And that trend is clearly getting drier and hotter as the years go on. Stephanie Ebbs, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brad.
Okay, one more quick break. When we come back, there will never be another queen of rock and roll like her. One last thing is next.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt the cartridge.
What were you thinking that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia. Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.
And one last thing. Wherever she was, she kept on burning.
Rolling, rolling.
The legendary singer Tina Turner died yesterday at the age of 83 in Switzerland, where she's lived for years. She'd been suffering from several health ailments. But she represented more than just the best of R&B, pop, and rock. She represented the ultimate comeback story.
Big wheel, keep on turning, turning.
Back in the early 1970s, she was quickly becoming a star. Ike Turner, already then an accomplished musician, was credited with jump-starting her career as they became a duo. He even picked out the stage name, Tina Turner, but in a sign of his controlling nature, he copyrighted her name so he could potentially give it to another singer if she ever left him.
My past was the reputation of my involvement, my environment, and what I was involved with, and I never had a part of it.
Tina divorced Ike Turner in the late 70s. Much later in life, she revealed the hell she had gone through at his hands.
Well, no promoters would book me because they felt, well, it's no longer Ike and Tina. She doesn't have a record. There's nothing I can promote.
But then something happened. Tina Turner remade herself, inside and out. If she was famous as half of a pair, as a solo act, she became iconic.
I just had too much energy left to do and to enjoy. And that is what I just stuck to. I just forget what the odds. I mean, people threw the age thing and they threw all kinds of things at me. And I just stuck to what I wanted. It was my dream.
Her 1984 record sold millions of copies. It won Grammys. And you could almost hear her spitting out these lyrics. What's love but a secondhand emotion? This artist who had been physically and psychologically abused within an inch of her life, asking, who needs a heart when a heart can be broken?
I got a number one record on my own, finally. Which that wasn't priority. That was to open a door, the movies, the world of movies.
She described herself as no longer caring what people expected from her. She starred in movies. She wrote books. She played Live Aid, prowling the stage with Mick Jagger. She oozed sex appeal, but often said she was playing for the women in the audience more than the men. Whether she knew it or not, she was laying the groundwork for countless women after her. Whitney Houston, Mariah Carey, Rihanna, Beyoncé. None would quite be the same without the legacy of Tina Turner. This was a woman who crossed genres, who rose like a phoenix. She showed us what it looked like to become bigger than any man, even the ones who try to make those around them feel small. She never lost 1 minute of sleeping, worrying about the way things might have been. She kept on burning.
Ooh, the proud Mary, keep on burning.
I never knew this until last night. Apparently, Tina Turner wasn't on board originally with What's Love Got to Do With It. She didn't like singing it until she settled on that vocal quality, that voice where she's practically growling, which as you hear it now is like the only way it ever could have been. More on all these stories at abcnews.com or the ABC News app. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt the cartridge.
What were you thinking at that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia, Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.